First, before I say anything else, I want to thank Donna and the committee, Michael, the other Michael, everybody that's already been with me today for asking me to do this, especially since this is where I live. This is such an honor and a privilege. It always is to be able to say thank you back to Alcoholics Anonymous again, but to be able to do it at a conference in your hometown, I don't know. For me, it's a first for me to do that at home, and it's also the scariest thing I've ever had to do. Because I know people out there. I mean, I feel kind of naked up here. You know, like, I'm used to not knowing anybody out there. And I know one friend of mine out there said that she's going to make sure I stay honest. And she can, because she knows me, you know. So this is a different experience to talk to people where I even recognize faces. I mean, you know, it'll be different. But I'll tell the truth, I think. At least I'm going to try to. I want to thank Michael and them for taking me to dinner, too. I have to confess, so that I'm going to do a disclaimer, I had a piece of Oreo cheesecake before coming here. And that's like one of my major leftover vices now. And it's one of the most fun things that I can still do every now and then. But it always makes me feel wonderful. And it's no telling what's going to come out of my mouth because of it. But I do need to do what the book says, and that's to share with you in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like today, with the key word being general. So I'm going to try to keep that in mind. I did ask God to take care of this today. And the message that I intend to share is the message of my spiritual awakening, as the big book suggests. So I'm not going to talk to you about my political views or some of my other pet peeves, even though this is one of those days that I would normally be talking about that. But now you've given me another memory for April 15th that I hope will supersede the future April 15th that I have to look forward to. Maybe you've given yourself another memory, who knows? Because April 15th was always kind of a down day for me, just because of, you know, what we do on that day. But anyway, the part about what I used to be like, I also like to say, since most of that time I wasn't conscious, it's anybody's guess how accurate this historian is going to be. Most of the time I wasn't conscious either because I was using a lot of chemicals or because I just had a knack for leaving and just being someplace else rather than in my skin and in my head. So I don't even remember a large part of growing up. I have bits and pieces of it, but the majority of it is just snatches. So I have a lot of people still telling me things that happened when I was growing up, so I kind of have to take their word for it. And then I think I do remember enough about what happened because that was the turning point that got me to AA. And then, of course, the today part should be fairly accurate, but who knows? I still have enough distortion left. So, but I started out in a military family. Yeah. I also tend to have mind farts every now and then. So if you're paying attention, I may have to ask somebody, now, where was I? Okay. I started out as an Army brat, hence the color still. You know, this is my one adventure with color. Those of you who know me know it is, because I always wear black. Always. It's my favorite color. But anyway, I started out in a military family. My dad was career, and so we moved every 2 or 3 years. I loved that, as a matter of fact. And the other thing about that was that I was always ready to go about halfway into his tour. I was always wondering, where's the next place? Because I never liked the place that I was in. I always hated it by about a year and a half into it, and I always knew that the next place was going to be better than this place. And interestingly enough, when I got into AA, and you all used to talk about geographic cure, I didn't relate to that at all. I just said, that's not me, because I was born to move. You know, it was like in the DNA. When you were born into the military, you just moved, doesn't everybody? So I never could figure that I never liked where I was. I also hadn't figured that I was the common denominator between me and every place I was. But I was always ready to go somewhere else. The other thing that I always remember is that I was never satisfied with anything. That I never liked the way anything was. I didn't like my parents. I had this feeling that I was in the wrong family, that I was like, you know, switched at birth kind of thing, you know, in the hospital. And because I knew my real parents would never have treated me like these people did. I also knew my real parents had money, lots of money. not too much fantasy. But that's the other thing. Fantasy was the way I lived. That's where I lived. That's what I wanted to live in. Reality was not where I wanted to be. I thought my parents didn't love me. I thought they were too strict. I felt oppressed, depressed, suppressed, every kind of pressed you can think of, I was. And I resented everything. I was the oldest of four. I resented that because I wanted to be the only of none others, okay? I also felt like I was trapped in this kid body, that I really was a grown-up, and somebody had tricked me. It was like some kind of cosmic joke, because I never felt like a kid. I hated being that. I'm not one of those people that will ever say I, you know, want to be a kid again or want to go back to childhood. I just hated it, and I wished the entire childhood away. I wanted to be grown because I knew one thing about adults. I knew they all did exactly what they want to do, all of them. And they all had power. So from the very beginning, what I remember wanting was power. And I wanted all of it. And the kind I wanted was that kind of omnipotent power. The kind that could, like, take that little wire that's back there hanging over Civic Center and make some kind of lethal weapon out of it and, like, wipe out half this audience. Just like that. I used to fantasize. I'm not fantasizing that now. Don't look too nervous. But I used to have those kinds of fantasies that I could do that. Early on, what I did was I would read about the Greek and Roman gods and goddesses, and I would just really hook into the ones of the underworld because they had most of the power, and they could zap, and they could change things. And I used to read a lot about magic and warlocks and witches, people who could do spells, people who could do those kinds of things, and I admired them. And then as I got older, I would get into books about assassins, things like Day of the Jackal, Chameleon, stuff like that. And I really wanted that kind of power, too, the kind that could kill. I really did. And I would have told you that who I was this gentle soul, this really kind-hearted, nonviolent person. But every time I was angry or afraid, particularly angry, what I would be thinking about was doing somebody in. Now, this is from, like, I'm talking 5, 6 years old. I'm not talking a big person yet that could do any of this stuff. But that's what I used to think about, because I always thought that if I got angry enough, I wanted to kill somebody. I mean, because they were going to kill me. So I had these kinds of thoughts as a kid. Don't know what it has to do with. Maybe it has nothing to do with alcoholism. But this is my thinking before I even drank, at least before I consciously drank. I do have to tell you that I did have my first drink when I was 3, according to my mother. She said that they had parties all the time, and this one particular time when I was 3, she remembers me going around after the party was over, and the half-finished beers and the half-finished scotches and whatnot were still there. Must not have been too many alkies at that party. And I came waddling out, she said, and I would pick up the cup, down it real fast, and then get real happy real fast, and start giggling and waddling around, and then, of course, trip and fall flat on my face, start crying, get mad, start stomping, almost kind of in a tantrum kind of thing, get back up, pick up another cup, swig it down again real fast, get happy again, waddle around, playing, happy, fall again, crying, flat on my face, get back up, take another drink, and start the whole thing all over again. Now, when she described me at 3 doing that, I was sober when I heard this story. She doesn't know, but she described, really, basically, the 17 years of my drinking career, because it looked like that. At the beginning, for a real short time, it looked real happy, because I was kind of a party person. And I slung them down, too, real fast. And I was happy, playful. And then maybe after 3 or 4 years, mine didn't last, my good times were not long good times. The bulk of that 17 years, I was mostly mad at everything, and I would tell anybody about it. And then the very last part of it, I was like totally, totally in despair. So bad that I was like the walking dead. I wanted to die, didn't know how to kill myself, didn't know how to be dead. But I hardly even remember that, because that was the time that I drank so much and used so many other kinds of chemicals that I hardly have a memory of that part of my life. But it was just downhill. So for 17 years in that 3-year-old, I did it in like about 30 minutes, according to my mother. Now that was the first drink. I have no memory of it. I believe what she said is true. I set out to try to be a good kid with my parents. I was one of those disgusting goody-two-shoes type kids in front of adults. I was like the Eddie Haskell of my neighborhood, the female Eddie Haskell, because behind their backs, I was liable to do anything. But in front of adults, I could do what they wanted because I could read them. I could read them from their back. And I always knew what they wanted. I knew how to say yes, Mrs. and yes, Mr. So-and-so and be real polite. But all the time, I was really wanting to get back and do sneaky things. And I got to be a good sneak. I learned early on that it's easier to beg forgiveness than to ask permission. I don't know where that came from, but I learned that in the house that I grew up in. So I always wanted to have the power, and I watched adults all the time, and the ones that I watched drank alcohol, smoked cigarettes, and drank black coffee, not necessarily in that order. And I was going to do all that when I grew up. I practiced it a little bit before I grew up. I did not try to do any of that stuff in high school because bad kids did that, and I didn't want to get in trouble. Before I went to college, my parents taught me how to drink at home so that I wouldn't make a fool out of myself when I got out of the house. So they taught me how to drink scotch and whiskey and all that nasty stuff that I didn't like, and I knew I was never going to do that because it was awful. I was going to drink what I wanted to drink, but I appreciated them trying to show me how to drink. But so all this time, I'm trying to be perfect. I'm getting A's, and I'm like the good kid. And I'm doing a lot of stuff that anybody would be happy about. The only thing is I wasn't happy because something was always missing in my life. The it was always missing. I was always looking for it, could never find it. And I did everything I could that I was told to do to get it, and it never happened until I got to college. I did that because they told me I had to do that. But once I got there, I was going to do what I wanted to do. And of course, the first thing I was going to do was drink. The other thing I was going to do was that I was going to figure out what had been wrong with me all my life. Because the other thing about me was, I knew I was crazy. I knew I was crazy. Yes, I knew I was crazy. And I've known that since I was about 10, and it always bothered me because in my family, you can't talk about things like that. It's not popular to have anything like that going on that you can't solve yourself. So I kept it to myself. But I knew since I was about 10 that there was something wrong with me mentally. So when I got to college, I was going to major in psychology, not because I wanted to help anybody, not because I care about other people, but because I was crazy. And I wanted to figure out what I had and cure it. I wasn't going anywhere. I was just going to find it in a book, because that was the other thing. The only thing I thought I had going for me was my brain, my intellect. And I thought if I could read it and study it, I could figure it out, and I could do it. If it was in a book, I could do it. Okay? So I get there, get to school, and I major in psych. And by the second year, which is coincidentally the sophomore year, and you know, sophomore means wise fool, that was the year I discovered what was wrong with me in a book. It was called Manic Depression. Now, I'm here to tell you that is not what was wrong with me then nor now. But it was in a book, and it looked like me. So it made sense. The main reason it made sense to me was because in that book it said that no orphans had ever been manic depressive because it came from some extreme parental anxiety, so that I could blame my parents for heaping all this anxiety on me and making me crazy. That's why I decided I was manic depressive, because it looked like your parents made you do it. So I was fine. Do you think I went and checked it out with anybody? No. Do you think I did anything else about it? No. What I did about it was what I always did about everything else. Because by that freshman year, the year before I discovered my insanity, I had the second best drink I've ever had. And that was Mogan David wine. I don't ever want to forget it. Because that was the first time I decided to drink the way I was going to drink for the next 17 years. It was in a cup similar to this. I was with an upperclassman, and I was scared going into that, because I hadn't dated that much either up until that time, and he was smarter than me, and he scared me because he had power, and I was an underclassman, and I didn't know anything. Plus, I hadn't had a drink yet on purpose. So he pours this Mogan David, and it wasn't even MD 2020, which I eventually graduated up to. It was just that table wine. So I guzzled it, which was could be my pattern. I am a guzzler, okay? I don't sip anything. So I guzzled this stuff down. It was syrupy sweet, kind of like Kool-Aid. But what happened for me, I hope I'll never forget, because that was the it that I had been looking for, second to none. When that stuff went through my veins, I had this metamorphosis like I had never had before. All that fear that I had had growing up, all that craziness that I thought I felt, all that not being able to ever amount to anything in my life disappeared instantly with that drink. It was like it shot through my veins, went all the way through me. I was gorgeous, I was witty, I was bright, I was powerful. I could do anything I wanted. And the thing that happened for me that I wasn't even looking for was that I could get mad too. And I could get mad and I could do it. I could let you know how mad I was and not have any remorse or guilt about it. And that night I got mad at somebody, told them off with the finger in the face, the whole nine yards, and I was at home in my soul. Because I had never been able to do that before. I was always too timid, too afraid to express anything. That drink just made me come alive. And I knew I was going to drink for the rest of my life because I was home. I hope I never forget that. It was like a spiritual experience. It was second to none. It was second to none. I never felt so good in my whole life up until that point. And I have never felt the way that I felt that day since that day. That particular way that that alcohol went into me never went into me quite the same way again. It got close. And I spent the next 17 years trying to get that again, and I never got it quite like that again. Never quite like that again. It got close. But I was home free. And the other thing that always happened to me happened that night, too. After that first drink, I wanted another one right away. And so the guy was being kind and everything, and he was trying to teach me how to slow down and stuff. And he said, "Michelle, I don't think you need, you know, you just did that real fast and da-da-da-da-da." And that's when the hand went on the hip and the neck started moving. And the belligerence and the arrogance and I know what I drink, da-da-da-da-da, and the four-letter word beginning with F started. And I mean, from then on, I had this attitude that went with drinking. And it just went with it all the time, all the time. It was just total metamorphosis. And when I wasn't drinking, which was a lot, by the way, I'm one of the what the big book calls a periodic drinker. I was not drinking a lot, too. So in between drinks, I was miserable because I was in withdrawal a lot. Now, I know that now, being in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know that then, but I was miserable being between drinks. So that's when I was more cranky and more irritable and more, you know, more, just more everything. Because I was waiting to get another drink. I didn't know that that was a good sign that I'm probably an alcoholic. I thought that meant I wasn't. Because you got to know the other thing. The whole time I was drinking, I was not an alcoholic. Because I knew what one of those was. First of all, it wasn't a female. You know, women really aren't alcoholics. We drink a little too much sometimes, but men are alcoholics. I heard that in my family. There were drunks in my family that were men. They died from cirrhosis of the liver. They wet their pants, and they were no good, and they weren't related to us. They married into the family. So I didn't have any problem with that. The women, even though they like hallucinated glasses of scotch floating through the air when they finally died from cirrhosis in the hospital, they just drank a little too much, you know. And they were never alcoholic. They still aren't alcoholic. In fact, with most members of my family, I am not an alcoholic to this day. I have some problems, but that's not it. And for some reason, I'm just trying to annoy them by hanging out with these moral degenerates who admittedly are sick. What can I say? But anyway, that's the way that first drink started. And I was off to the races. I drank kind of weekend type thing, party type thing, just to kind of be with the people that drank. And I don't know if people drank like me or not, really. The other thing I did really early on was, you know, the booze was good and it made me feel like I've wanted to feel. And I immediately discovered my booze came either liquid, freeze-dried, or smoked, okay? I immediately discovered freeze-dried booze. I was in college, and one of the things we had to do was stay up and study. And you know, everybody studies with speed because it helps you stay up. It has nothing to do with being a drug addict. I don't want to make anybody think that. I was not that. Mine were always prescriptions. Now, it doesn't matter that they weren't. They were always paid for by somebody, not necessarily me, because the prescriptions didn't always have my name on them. But they were given to me. I never just, you know, requisitioned them or anything. They were given to me. But they weren't always mine, but, you know, details. Anyway, so I started out with that combination of freeze-dried and booze to kind of keep me going. I could drink a lot longer that way, and I didn't have the hangover problems that way. I remember one time I drank 6 days in a row that way, you know, but normally I didn't drink like that. Normally I just drank every now and then when I could and when it made sense to me to do it. And that's kind of the way I did it through college. But then when I got out, I was free. And once I was free, I drank just about any time I wanted. But I needed to have more freeze-dried booze because my nerves got bad. Okay, so I had to go to a lot of doctors and explain to them about my nervous condition. And I was drinking during the time that doctors did think that alcoholism was a Valium deficiency. Okay, so I got a lot of that, and I wasn't even trying to do it. I mean, I would usually go in January to have my physical. Now, I was also usually suicidal every January. So I would go in and just be depressed and cry, and, you know, they would ask me normal questions like, are you going to have children? And I would go off into this tirade about why I would bring another black child into this world is beyond me, and why you would ask me a stupid question like that. And I'd be hysterical in like 3 minutes, and the guy would be furiously writing stuff, you know. And then I'd take the stuff because I knew I needed it. My nerves were bad. I used to shake a lot. I used to just vibrate a lot. And I couldn't sleep. I had really bad insomnia, and I had stomach problems. But I wasn't an alcoholic, and I wasn't a drug addict, okay? I was just, you know, nervous, high-strung, very sensitive person. Very sensitive. You know, it's funny. I was in an AA meeting one time, and I was leading it, and I said to the people in part of my lead that I was sensitive. And I don't know what I was talking about, but anyway, this guy in the audience said his sponsor told him that Beethoven was sensitive. And that Mozart was sensitive. Picasso was sensitive. But alcoholics are damn touchy people. I'm sensitive. But anyway, so I drank pretty much periodically. Then I started deciding that, you know, in my 20s, I decided I better do some things that grown-ups do, you know, like get married and have the 2.2 and the 1.7 in the picket fence and the, you know, make your age and all that kind of stuff that you're supposed to do when you get out of college. And so I tried that. It didn't work, probably because I drank all the way through it and never could connect emotionally with this man that I was married to, who was a very nice guy. The one thing that really attracted me to him, though, was how he drank. We met in a bar. We really did meet in a bar. I wonder if you guys arranged all these tornadoes and stuff today. This has really been something. But anyway, yeah, we met in a bar, so that should tell you where that relationship was going to go. You know, it just was kind of doomed from the start. It lasted about 6 years, though, and it made a turning point in my whole drinking career, because up to that point, I was trying to pull it off to be this person that I thought I could be, this fantasy person who could make it in the corporate world and move on up that ladder and have this perfect husband and this perfect life and do this perfect thing that I was supposed to do according to somebody, and I don't even know who, but somebody had told me I was supposed to do this, and it just didn't seem to quite make it, because 6 years into that relationship, we got divorced. Now, at that point, that was the worst thing that could have happened, and my drinking took a turn like you wouldn't believe. And I have to remember another time it took a turn, too, that was way before that. It was in 1969, which was about 25 years ago. I've only just recently remembered this. But I've heard people from up here talk about that line that we cross sometimes, that invisible line. I don't know what that is, but I do know that my drinking took several kind of dives, and one of them was in 69 when I was a junior in college. I had three really bad things happen that I considered horrible. That year, when the third thing happened, I remember kind of ritualistically taking like a 12-ounce glass and filling it to the top with whiskey. No ice, and I was in so much pain from what had happened, I announced to my girlfriend that was there with me that when I drink this, I will never, ever feel this way again. Nobody will ever hurt me like this again, and I am never going to go through anything like this again. Nobody will ever get to me again. And I drank that 12-ounce glass somewhere during the course of that evening. I have no more memory after that glass for the rest of that evening. But I'm here to tell you that because of that, certain things have still never happened to me again, just like I said they wouldn't happen to me again. Because I closed off a part of me then that has just been shut off for a long time. I believe Alcoholics Anonymous is helping me get that back. But that shut down, it was like it became non-existent. Then when the divorce came, I did it again. I had the pain again. I had the shame now of being divorced, because that did not happen in my family. In fact, my mother still considers it an affront to her that I did this back in whenever it was. And I mean, it was a first, and it was the worst, and it was awful, and I just knew I would never get through that. And I mean, for a whole week, I was just oblivious. I couldn't go to work. I started eating pills and drinking vodka, and that's all I did for a week. No food, just did that, just stayed blitzed. Because when I had that kind of pain, if somebody was going to leave me, I was going to die. And I couldn't kill myself, but I could just keep drinking just to try to kill the pain. And I remember again during that time, as I'm drinking a glass of vodka, I say, this is never going to happen to me again. Nobody is ever going to hurt me like this again. And I ritualistically downed that booze, and there it was, just stuffed it right on down. And that's the way I handled stuff then. No matter what was going on with me, that's what took care of it. It was my first and only solution. And I tried other stuff. I mean, I went to therapy when I was drinking, if you can imagine that. Talk about good money after bad. I'd be popping pills going in and drinking booze going out because I couldn't deal with anything. I didn't want to feel anything. That was my whole goal, not to feel anything about my life. I did not like anything about it, and the feelings about it were horrible. And I never wanted to feel them. I loved Spock. Spock was my idol because he didn't feel anything. I was a Trekkie just because of Spock. I loved him. He didn't even laugh. I loved Stoics. I loved reading about the Greek Stoics. I thought it was something to aspire to be able to be like that, not feel anything, just be like this dial tone. But I couldn't continue to do that. There was another part of my life, too, where I was looking for God, I believe. I mean, it was short-lived, but it was like right at the beginning of college, I started majoring in religion. I was trying to figure out, what is this deal that people are all hooked on? I had begun my education in Catholic school, which is a real kind of eye-opening experience in kindergarten and first grade. I mean, they scared me to death. And I never became Catholic, but I wanted to. I wanted to real bad because they had a lot of rules, and I thought, you know, maybe that would help me. But instead, I was scared of the nuns because I thought they didn't have any bodies. I thought they just had heads and hands, you know, because I'm dating myself about how they used to dress back then. And they also told you if you saw their hair, you'd go to hell. And they told me, you know, and I saw Sister Michelle's Widow's Peak one day, and I knew I was doomed. I mean, I was 5 years old, and I was doomed. So, you know, my life was just kind of in the toilet from the beginning. And I never seemed to be able to quite get it. I would get real close, but I would never quite get it. And so finally, in those last few years, I just kind of existed. Nothing went well. I didn't even have good relationships. I don't even remember having too many after a while. I just kind of like floated in and out of stuff, and then I just kind of gave up. I was kind of upset with you guys anyway, because I had things, like when I drank, one of the things I did was I got dressed to so many drinks, like it was a 1.5 glass of wine event, you know, from the shower to the door. Now that was provided you got there on time. You were supposed to be on time, by the way, and if you weren't, you did hear it from me. I was good at taking your inventory and letting you know exactly when you were wrong, promptly admitting it kind of thing. So I had this, you see, by the end of my drinking, I couldn't drink much before I would go into hangover symptoms. And it was awful. And I'd be having a hangover like right now while I'm still drinking. It wouldn't wait till tomorrow. I'd be nauseous. And, you know, it was just awful. So if a guy was late and I'd had my 1.5 and I'm ready to go so we can go drink, well, what am I supposed to do? And see, then if I have to keep drinking, then I'm going into that hangover thing, and I can't be doing that because then I can't have any fun when I get there. So I would be reading you the riot act when you finally did show up. If you showed up, you know who you are. I think I had this magnet in my underwear. You know, I used to call. Because I did attract a certain type man, and most of you were sitting out in the audience. I thought I was here, placed on this earth, to educate you, usually in the art of drinking and the art of controlling your drinking, because that was what I did. I mean, I considered myself a controlled drinker. I even used to measure my wine with shot glasses. That's disgusting. I mean, I made what they call wine spritzers, and I would measure them in a shot glass. You know, put the wine in a shot and a half, and then maybe 3 shots of the spritz part, you know. The other thing I knew about was I was one of those alcoholics that never drank more than maybe one or two drinks. The reason is because I figured out what one drink was. One drink is when you pour the drink in and you drink it down to where maybe you've got 2 inches left in the glass. You don't finish the glass. Then you pour more alcohol on top of that. It's one drink. It only becomes two drinks when you finish the glass and it's empty. You understand? So as long as you can never empty the glass and keep pouring the booze, you've got the one drink. Now, every now and then I would forget and it'd be empty, so that would be two. But usually that was like at 3 a.m, and you know, who cares? So you had maybe two drinks, you know, and I would be telling the truth, maybe two drinks. The other thing is I always had my bottle, you know, and you had the other stuff. I never ran out of booze. I'm not one of those, see, because I wasn't an alcoholic. They run out of booze. I didn't run out of booze. And I had my bottles of wine that nobody drank out of but me. And in fact, when you left, if you didn't drink everything, it went back in my bottle. And I would do this little mantra, alcohol kills germs, alcohol kills germs, pour it right back in the bottle, not even worry about it. I never told anybody that I did this, but I knew alcohol killed germs, so it didn't matter. In fact, that was why sometimes I could even finish your drink after you left. Because it didn't bother me, because alcohol killed germs. Now, I was the same person who would talk about you bad if you smoked dope after somebody you didn't know. You don't know where that's been, where their mouth has been. You know, and I would just never do that after somebody. But I would drink after anybody, the clone of Jack the Ripper, I would drink after. Because alcohol kills germs. The other thing is, you know, when I got in the program, I remember thinking about how I couldn't trust you folks because I don't know you from Adam, you know, and you're telling me stuff and I can't believe what you're telling me. I can tell you that when I was drinking and I would go to parties with God only knows who, and they would come up to me and offer me God only knows what, and tell me that it would do these wonderful things to me. Before they finished telling me what it would do, I was already eating it, whatever it was. Then I'd be asking them the most important question, can you drink with this? Because that's all I wanted to know. And they'd always say, sure. Now, these weren't medical people, necessarily. I mean, if they were, it doesn't matter. They were blitzed at the time. I don't know if they made it in their basement, what it was, but I would just take that. Now, that's what I call trust. Maybe misguided, but at least I knew how to trust somebody. I knew how to have faith in something that I knew nothing about. So I remembered after I got sober that I could translate that same kind of behavior with somebody that at least was trying to help me. But I went along like that. I also, I was one of those people that when I was drinking, I discovered things. Like, I used to drink scotch first, scotch and whiskey, brown liquor, and I started getting headaches. So I knew what was wrong with it. It was the food coloring in the liquor, because I'm really bright. So I switched from brown to white, vodka, gin, that sort of thing, because it didn't have the food coloring, and therefore I wouldn't get the headaches and the hangover feelings, except when I did get the headaches and the hangover feelings. But, you know, that was much later. And, in fact, in those days when I was a vodka drinker and a gin drinker, vodka was my favorite, and I would say the only thing white I like is vodka. That was in the 60s, so you can kind of tell where my political persuasion was. But I got over the vodka kick, got over the scotch kick. Oh, the other thing I knew, too, was how many calories that had, you know, because I would always do these diets where you could drink on them. You know, that's a whole nother story, but anyway. But finally, I discovered wine, because the hard liquor was the problem. And beer was something I never drank. I just want you to know that that was a blue-collar kind of thing to do, and I didn't do that, except if that was all they had. Now, I would talk about them like dogs when I left, but especially if they had it on tap. That's when I really went for it. And I could start like now and still keep doing it if it stayed on a tap, you know, and especially if I never went to the bathroom during any of that time. Because, you know, once you start, you might as well just stay in there with the beer. But I hated beer. It smelled bad. It was gross. It made you belch and all that kind of stuff. So I never drank it, except if that's all you had. There were a lot of things I never drank, except if that was all you had. You know, and then I'd talk about you because you were supposed to ask me what I drank first, you know, that kind of thing. But anyway, because I was one of those people that, like, knew where the grapes were grown and everything with the wine. I had finally discovered some wine that I liked at the very end there. I had gone to Chicago and found some Italian, like Frascati and Bolla, Suave, and these beautiful bottles. And I found some liqueurs, some Ataxa, and oh, I was just in heaven because I was studying the the wine and it was the aroma and everything, and I was finally tasting it because I hated booze. All this time, I hated the taste of liquor. It's gross when you hate the taste of liquor if you're an alcoholic, because what I had to do was get loaded fast enough so that the taste quit bothering me, you know, because I hated the taste and the smell. It was awful. But when I got to this wine, I loved it. And that was right near the end, because now I can tell you about the best drink I ever had. The best drink I ever had. It was Easter weekend, 1982, in Columbus, Ohio. It was low-cal wine, so I could drink and lose weight at the same time. It had just come out. I wish I knew the name of it. I never did find that out, because I thought I was in heaven then. I was gonna, and I bought everything by the case, so you know I was going to buy cases of that. But that day, I remember I was in a Friday's restaurant, which was one of my favorites, and I was cutting a business deal because I was going to make a whole bunch of money, back into the fantasy again. I was going to quit this raggedy-ass job I had, and I was going to go over here and make all this money, and I was happy. The sun was shining. That already should tell you that's a miracle. This was in Ohio. The sun was shining. We used to count days a year that the sun shined in Ohio, but the sun was shining. I was happy. I wasn't even mad at my mother that day, which is another story, but that, you know, it's not one thing, it's your mother. But that day, it wasn't even that. And I was getting ready to sign on the dotted line, and I had like two sips of that low-cal wine, and that was it. And with those two sips, that thing that always happened to me again. It was that switch that would always happen to me with my personality. I mean, but this time it was like loud, and I thought the person in front of me could see it, because inside I changed instantly, and it scared me. I thought I was having some kind of breakdown right there in front of this woman on two sips. And so she looked at me and said, "What's going on?" I said, "Nothing, it's just the wine, you know, I'm okay." And she said, "Oh, it's the wine." And I said, "Well, no, it's not the wine, it's just that I can't think when I drink." "Oh, well, then it is the wine." "No, it's just that when I drink, I can't really do things, you know, and I have to go home now." So all of a sudden I left her, and she said, "But why are you leaving? It must be the wine." I said, "No, it's just that I have to pack, I'm moving, and when I drink, I can't move too well. You know, I just can't do much when I drink." "Well, it must be the wine." "No, you don't understand." "But you don't understand. It's not the wine. It's just that I can't function when I'm drinking. So, you know, let me just go." So anyway, and I'm saying all this, and I don't even know what I'm talking about. I get home, and that was when I think I first recognized God's intervention in my life. And I'm not saying that God had never intervened on this alcoholic, because I don't think I'd be standing here, because I used to do stuff in blackouts, like drive my car and stuff. And I remember when I even first started drinking, when I was not even drinking that much, I was in a hotel room with a boyfriend who was the cousin to a pimp who was getting money from a prostitute who was shooting heroin, and a monkey was running around the room. Now, this was like stark raving sober. I'm standing here with my little books going to the library, and I'm watching this scene. I'm in here. I'm in this room. I'm not like watching television. I'm in it. And I remember thinking, what's a nice girl like you doing in a place like this? Then I also remember thinking, I'm looking at me. I was 18 years old. I remember thinking, I'm looking at where I'm going. I mean, it left me that quick, but I remember thinking it. Now, thank God I didn't get all the way there, but I could see that that would be a place I could go very easily, because that's who I was with. When I was in eighth grade, the teacher said, "Show me with whom you associate, and I'll tell you what you are." I never forgot that man, and look at who I associate with today. But anyway, that last drink, I get home, and I'm dating one of you folks out there that need help with your drinking, and he had pissed me off once again, which is what you always did, one day at a time. And so I had completely forgotten that I had any problem with that wine, and I went to try to fix him. So I was looking for some literature, and by the way, I was also self-appointed to save family members from this dreaded disease. And I would go to the mental health department and get all kinds of literature about alcoholism. And I had a box of it for some reason, because nobody ever kept it. They always kept giving it back to me. So I had a box of it in my basement. And I remember getting it out, because I thought there was going to be something in there that would say, this is how you talk to a drunk so that he doesn't hit you when you piss him off because you're trying to get him out of your house. I mean, it was something to that effect. I knew there would be a title like that. So anyway, I grabbed these books, and there was a pamphlet in there. And I sit down, and the pamphlet starts out, "My name is John, and I'm an alcoholic." And then it went on to tell his story, just like I'm telling my story. And I started reading that, and I was in there. Rochelle Moore was in there. And I started crying. And I couldn't stop crying because I am an alcoholic. And that was the first time "I am" came out of my mouth. Prior to that, I had a predisposition towards alcoholism and chemical dependency, and when it gets bad enough, I'll do something about it. Thank you very much. But do not talk to me about anything I'm doing, because it ain't that bad yet. That's the way I always addressed it. That day, I said, "I am." And I knew that I could not ever drink again that day. I knew that. And I knew there was a God that day, which is real strange, because I didn't even believe in God. Or where I was really was that I didn't believe that God liked me. I thought God was mad at me because I didn't believe in God, if you can get to that. But that's where I was. I thought God was mad at me. So for me to even think that God was going to help me. And then the third thought that I know was God was that I knew that there was Alcoholics Anonymous. Because that hadn't been a part of my life. There was a drunk that I worked with that was in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I did not even like him. And he was the only big book I had ever read. So don't worry about who you are and what kind of personality you have, because you can even piss people off and get people to the program. This guy used to always be on my case, and he was real crotchety and everything. But what he did for me, for 5 years, he listened to me talk about somebody else's alcoholism. And he listened and kept telling me what he knew was the truth about alcoholism. And he would say things like, "You know, inside of that person is a beautiful person who's a sick person, not a bad person. She's trying to get well. She's not bad trying to get good. She's sick trying to get well." And I would say, "But you don't understand. She's really a da-da-da-da-da-da-da." He was always talking about me. I was never talking about me. And he would listen to me. He didn't push anything. He just listened. And he kept telling me that there was hope and that that person could get better if they would stop drinking. And I would say, "They'll never stop drinking." So he was real instrumental in me getting sober. Easter Sunday, I had the last chemical that I've ever had to this day. And for that, I thank God totally, because that has nothing to do with me. I really relate to Bill Wilson about the sedatives in the morning. That was me. Because, see, I told you about this nerve problem I had. Like, I had the shakes really bad. And this was the first time in my life I had ever said, "I'm not going to drink again." And I woke up vibrating. I mean, it was like an earthquake or something. And the next thing I know, I'm taking this trank because I knew that that would calm these nerves. Well, it really didn't calm the nerves. But something told me, too, that there's got to be another way to do this. There's got to be. So when I read Bill's story and saw what he did to calm his nerves, I thought, that is an alcoholic like me. Thank God I saw another alcoholic like me. That was Easter Sunday, 1982, April 11th. Somebody else woke up that morning, not the person that went to bed the night before. And when I read in the big book about that "we were reborn" business, I really identified with that line, because who woke up that morning was not who went to bed. And who woke up that morning said, "I am going to Alcoholics Anonymous." Now, I didn't go that day because I told you how smart I am. I knew it was a holiday. You guys don't meet on holidays. I didn't even bother to call. I called Monday, got this guy who was the president. He was the, he was the manager of Central Office in Columbus, Ohio. Well, I didn't know anything about this organization. So what I did was I asked him if there were any counselors there. That's what I asked him. He said, "No." And then I thought, what kind of a rinky-dink organization is this? You know? He said, "This is Alcoholics Anonymous, and we're here." I thought, oh my God, the man is drunk. And then I knew that I'd gotten a live one. Because, see, I wasn't that bad, and I knew I could humor the guy. You know, maybe somebody would come and get him off the phone, and then I could talk to some professional. Because I knew I needed to talk to a professional. Not a professional drunk. But anyway, so the guy keeps talking. And then he got even more gross. He started getting real personal and telling me his business. He didn't know who I was. I could have been from the FBI. Could have been from 60 Minutes. He's telling me embarrassing things about his life that I did not want to hear. And I did not relate to this guy at all. He was a drunk, he said. I am not a drunk. I told him, I'm an alcoholic. I'm not a drunk. So, I mean, we went back like this, back and forth, back and forth. Finally, the guy says, just before he hung up, because I said I just wanted a meeting, and I figured you met two or three times a month like any other normal organization. He wanted me to go that night. I mean, I don't know what his problem was. I told him I was busy. You know, I had to play racquetball, I had to get my hair done, a whole bunch of stuff. So he finally got exasperated enough that he said, right at the end, he said, I just want to tell you one thing before I hang up this phone. He said, ma'am, right now as we speak, you are out of control. You are out of control as we speak. Well, he said the C word to somebody who has got to stay in control. That was my whole reason for breathing, was to be in control. And when he said that, of course, I lost it. I ended up screaming at him, hanging, you know, almost wanting to hang up on him. And at the end of that tirade, he said, that's not what I meant by out of control. What you're doing right now, I didn't mean hysterical. He said, what I meant was, I don't believe that you have ever called anybody and asked anybody for help for yourself in your life. That is out of control. And he said, we all have to get there before we can go anywhere else. And he was right. I had never asked anybody about me. I had always asked about somebody else. So that began my entry into this fellowship. And I'd like to tell you that it was hell. I got well, and now it's well, or something to that effect. But I'm one of those people, as bad as it was before, I'm here to tell you it got worse after I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I am ever so grateful to people who did not tell me what was probably coming down the road for me. Probably nobody would have known, and if they did, they wouldn't tell anyway. But I mean, you know, they kept saying, it'll get better. Well, I don't know what that is, and I never have understood that, because it has gone to hell in a handbasket in my life. It is like who's president and what the weather is and that tornado out there. It just keeps on doing. What has gotten better, though, is me on the inside, because this is an inside job. My outsides looked great when I got sober. Basically, I told you all the gory inside stuff, but on the outside, on paper, it didn't look that bad to most people. I mean, it was okay. It was inside I was like totally decayed and dead. So I come in the program, and of course, you know, after about 3 days in AA, I had overreacted to this whole thing because I felt better, you know, because I wasn't even drinking that much my last year. The last week I drank, I had 3 drinks in the whole 7 days and didn't even finish the last one. I mean, so I was just really controlling. I got into major withdrawal that first year. I walked into AA vibrating. And I just thought I was better than everybody else because I was still smarter than everybody else, I thought. So I could read the big book, interpret it, and just go on, take notes, and get an A in AA. That's what I wanted to do. I did not understand people here. I thought you were the most self-centered people. And I knew the big book said it, but I mean, you added new meaning to self-centeredness. First of all, you don't listen to anybody. You know what they say about four alcoholics talking in a conversation? You have four monologues. See, everybody's trying to share their own experience, and can you top this? So that's what I thought everybody was doing. I thought nobody listened in AA to anybody else. And everybody laughed all the time at people's sadness and sorrow. I mean, you know, in meetings, you know, the chairperson would say, is there a topic? And a new person would always be talking about some horrible stuff. I mean, you know, like the cat, like one of my friends here calls it flat tires and the cat died. But, you know, the divorce and my husband beat me and, oh, I don't know, and I think I might drink and, that I, you know, I'm about to be sued for this, that, and the other. And the chairperson would say something like, I think the topic is the first step. And I'd be sitting there going, he didn't even listen to this woman. She needs a lawyer, for God's sake. They need to put that man in jail. You know, I mean, I would have given my card, you know, and help this poor soul. You know, but they'd say stupid things like, don't drink, go to meetings, read the big book, and pray. Call your sponsor. And I thought, what are they talking about? I never understood them. They spoke this other language. It was kind of a Zen thing, you know, and they never made any sense. I mean, like this old-timer I went up to, and I was always trying to get him. I was one of those gotcha people. I would go up to the old-timers and try to get them, try to trick them, try to trip them up, because they always never made sense to me. And I remember once I discovered that you didn't have to take your fifth step with your sponsor. Somebody had told me that, or I'd read it or something. And I was thrilled because I didn't really want to take it with my sponsor at that time. So I go to this old timer and I said, guess what? I found out you don't have to take a fifth step with your sponsor. He said, well, yeah, but why didn't you ask somebody? Well, because I thought I knew. Well, yeah, so why didn't you ask somebody? Well, because when I know, I mean, I don't ask anybody. Yeah, well, you should have asked somebody. I said, yeah, but you don't understand. If I know, why would I ask anybody? I mean, well, Rochelle, you should have asked somebody. Why didn't you ask somebody? And I thought, this guy drank a little bit too long. I'll leave, I'll come back. 2 days later, I come back, and I figure he didn't remember anyway. He was old, he had too many drinks, and, you know, he had been sober a long time, too, so he hadn't had enough. So anyway, I said it to him again, the whole thing again, and he said, yeah, I remember 2 days ago when you said the same thing, and I'll say the same thing back. When you think you know, ask somebody. And I said, but you don't understand. When I know something, I never ask anybody. He said, Rochelle, when you know, ask somebody. I mean, finally, I got it. See, other people were telling me things like, you don't know anything, you think you're so smart, you're stupid, da-da-da-da-da. But he said a different way, and for some reason, I got it. I still don't always practice it. But they always talk like that. You know, like when you know you don't know, it's when you really know, you know? It's when you think you know everything that you don't know anything. And I mean, I couldn't understand that. You got to die to win, surrender to win, and let it go to keep it, give it away to keep it. I mean, it was just all this backwards kind of jargon, and I thought it was a Zen thing. You know, I couldn't figure it out. Like, what is the sound of one hand clapping is what it sounded like. Oh, I could never figure out when the student is ready, the teacher appears. It took me like 3 years to understand that. 3 years. When the student is ready, the teacher appears. I was like, what? And see, I thought I was so smart. I would look in the big book. The print was real big. I knew it was for retarded people, like third grade. What I couldn't tell anybody was I didn't understand a word in it. Nothing. And it terrified me because I'm brilliant. And these synapses had stopped. I mean, I couldn't figure it out. I would read that chapter where these guys get drunk again. I forget where it is. More about alcoholism or something. The guy with the scotch and milk on the roadside cafe with the sandwich. I read that and it was, you got to go back and have a drink and then you come back in AA. Well, I was terrified because I didn't want to go back and have a drink and come back in AA. Well, nobody told me I had to go back and have a drink and come back. But I knew because I read it somewhere. Finally, I asked somebody, I mentioned to somebody that, you know, I'm really not ready to go have that drink. What drink? Well, you know, the one with the milk and the scotch and everything, you know, that goes with the... So then they go, Rochelle, they had the drink for you, dummy. They always called me dummy and that kind of stuff. You know, but I couldn't understand anything. I didn't know what a step was. If it had come in and hit me in the face, what is a step? I remember bringing up a topic once. What is a program? You all keep talking about your program. What is your program, for God's sake? I mean, the whole meeting, I wanted them to tell me what, and I mean, then they started talking, and I didn't know anymore when they finished that meeting than I knew when they started. They kept talking about my program, and I just, what is the program? I mean, it boggled my mind, and I thought they were just playing with me. I was mad that first year. I didn't like anybody, but here's the other thing. I didn't think you knew what you were talking about, and the way I was going to prove it was I was going to do exactly what you said and drink, because what you said didn't make any sense, and it wasn't going to work. I was going to go to 90 meetings in 90 days, because that's what you said do, and since I'm so task-oriented, I went to like 200 and some in 90 days, but who's counting? I was reluctantly going to get that sponsor, but you know I really didn't need one, but I was going to get one and call her, and I was going to talk to other women in the program. I was going to read the book every day, even though I couldn't understand it. It was for retarded people. It didn't matter. I was going to work the steps. I was going to pray and meditate, even though I didn't believe in God and didn't want to be religious, and you all were religious fanatics. I was even going to do it on my knees because that's what they did there. So I was going to do all that and drink to prove to you that this program does not, in fact, work. And the best way to do it is to do what you said and then drink. Well, as luck would have it, I did what you said mostly, and I didn't drink. Because you always said, before anything of those other things, you always said, don't drink. I mean, they always started out every sentence with, don't drink, don't drink, don't drink, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And they used to also say, don't drink even if your ass falls off up there. They said that. If I knew you better, I'd tell you that story, that it did, and I didn't. But that's too personal. But it did, and I didn't. So don't drink even if your ass falls off. But anyway, my life got worse because my life was already getting worse. I just stopped drinking, but it kept going on. And the one thing, you know, there's a part in the fifth chapter that says some of us tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil. That is what almost killed me. That is what kept me from even getting into the essence of step one, the powerlessness. My old idea was that if I can read it, think it, do it, then I'm in control of it. And I can handle my life, thank you very much, as long as I'm not drinking. The first step for me was I was powerless while I was drinking. Once I quit drinking, I'm fine. And I can handle my life, my relationships, my money, whatever. Okay? So I found another husband in Alcoholics Anonymous. I found a lot of things in Alcoholics Anonymous, lost a lot of things too, and found and lost and found. But I found this guy, and it was one of those AA romances, you know, if you want what I have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it. One of us said that to the other one. And of course, I need to tell you, I was 7 months sober when I found this, all right? And he was about 1 month. So between the two of us, we might have had one or two good working brain cells still firing. And that looks like about 5 minutes sobriety, give or take a second or two. So that's the brain that made the decision to do this thing. Now, I waited 2.5 years, which is really light years away from 7 months sobriety. You know, I wish I knew today what I knew when I was 2 years old in Alcoholics Anonymous, because then I was quoting the big book, not reading it, mind you, just quoting it. You know, I'd hear somebody quote it, and I'd go to another meeting and quote it. But that's what I did, because I thought that I could still live my life exactly the way I wanted to, without the booze, in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so for the first 5 years of my sobriety, I set out to do that. Well, I'm here to tell you, it doesn't work. And if anybody's trying to do it that way, you know, I really feel for you, because I know how much pain you're going to be in if you're not already in it. Because I caused myself so much trouble. What I did was I did just enough to look like I was still doing everything I was supposed to do. I did get into the steps, because I'm sincerely, sincerely desiring to stay sober. I got into the steps, I went to step meetings, I went to big book studies, I did talk to a sponsor, I went to a ton of meetings, I think that saved my butt that I went to so many meetings, and I knew a lot of women in the program who spoke the truth of Alcoholics Anonymous. So that by the time I was 5, when my life came crashing down around my ankles, I had learned how to stay sober. That's about all I had learned, but I had learned how not to pick up a drink of alcohol and put it in my body. And that's what I had learned, and I could do that because I needed to know how to do that, and I understand the importance of that now more than ever, because at 5 years sober, I still didn't even know what had happened in my life. At 5 years sober, I did not have a clue who I am. All I knew was that I didn't want to drink more than anything else. My life ended. It seemed like it just totally ended at 5. I remember when my sponsor gave me my chip, she said, "Honey, have you come to yet?" And I mean, she was joking, but I listened to that question. I had not come to. As we say in step two, we came to. And then we came to believe. I hadn't come to. I hadn't heard the pop. You know the pop. When your head comes out of your ass at 2. 5, excuse me. That was probably a Freudian slip. At 5, mine didn't come out at 2 either, or 5. So I had not come to yet. I was coming to at 5, but I didn't have a clue. That marriage ended, and it ended with a just real abrupt, sudden boom, which is the way it was supposed to end, I do believe. And there I was, and I was hurting really badly, really badly. No booze, no pills, and I'm dying inside, and I don't know what to do. I had just discovered Joe and Charlie of the Big Book Study, Joe and Charlie, on tape only. We were doing it at a Big Book Study on Wiley Road, and they were talking about the fourth step. On tape, I'm listening to these guys. And I didn't know what to do, and they were talking about working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and my God, if that wasn't a good idea. What a concept. I mean, I could kill myself, or I could work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Gee, I could have had a V8. I mean, that's what I had been hearing for all those 5 years about the steps, but I couldn't figure out when and why and what and all this. So I'm studying the steps, and my life changed. Step 3 finally made sense to me, because once I make the decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, then what you see me doing right after that is something in action, into action, not into activity, as my friend Bob P. says. I was into activity for the first 5 years. And I think that's okay. Because I had to do the activity, do the stuff, till I could stay sober long enough to get sober and begin to get on the inside. And to me, the inside of this program is very tough. It's not for weaklings. That's why I don't worry about alcoholics. We are not fragile people. We weren't fragile out there drunk, and I don't believe anybody who works the steps is a fragile person, because there's a lot of pain involved. By the time I got to the fourth step and finally did it like the big book, because I thought they were so outdated, I wouldn't do it that way. At the beginning, I thought, God, that was written in 1930-something. I mean, I know there's some more modern ways to do this. And so I did the modern ways. Well, hell, I never got any relief till I did it like the big book. That's when I discovered who I was mad at. I mean, Bill Wilson tells me you got to find out who you were mad at, because every time you got mad, you got drunk. And you at least hurt yourself and a couple other people. So find out who you're mad at. Then you'll find out what you always do when you're mad. And then look at how scared you've been, because that's why you always got mad. So I had to do that, and I found out who I was mad at. Even though I had this list of maybe 50 people, I was mad at 2 people. And every now and then, some of you guys remind me of them. That's all. 2 people. It really is a list of 2 people. And as long as I work on what that was all about, then I can know that you aren't either one of them today in 1994. I don't have to act like I always did when I had the feelings I always had. And with the fear, I now know what to do about fear, if I can remember to immediately ask God to remove the fear and then to do the next right thing. When I move into 6 and 7, I am doing me alive and in living color the way I always did without the booze. You are seeing me do a lot of the same behavior, a lot of it. They say our adventures before and after make clear 3 pertinent ideas. Back in Ohio, we call that stark raving sober. It's not a pretty sight to watch me be me, minus the booze, but doing the stuff. But the beauty of it is I get to see me feel what's going on and notice that this has got to change, because they used to say the same person will drink again. And that's me. I believe I will drink again if I don't change my behavior. So in 6 and 7, and those are prayerful steps, when I'm doing this stuff and causing myself pain, both of those steps tell me to ask God to do something. They don't say ask Rochelle to do anything. They say ask God to remove these defects of character and shortcomings. So then finally, I'm still trying to clean up my side of the street, making my list and making amends to people. I had one amend that didn't even come up till I was 8 years sober, and I had written it down way back when. And I kind of just wrote it just because I thought, well, I must have done something to him. I mean, I didn't even know what. I just knew that I was mad enough at this person, I must have had something to make an amend for. I can tell you to this day that until I was 8 years sober and that man appeared back in my life again, I did not have a clue what the amend was I was supposed to make. All I was willing to make it. And it wasn't until we were face to face and some things happened and the memories came back that I knew in my gut what I had done, that I needed to set right. So this program is just so divinely inspired. All I had to do was be willing. I didn't have to know anything. The 10th step has become more important to me these last couple of months, because we were taught to do that right away. When they told me to call a sponsor every day and talk to her and call other women every day and talk to them and tell them the truth, I didn't know I was getting to practice step 10, which tells me to continue to watch for resentment, selfishness, dishonesty, and fear, and ask God to remove these, because these are spiritual blocks, and at once talk to somebody. We've been practicing step 10 since day 1. I didn't have a clue that's what I was doing. Today, I'm more appreciative of it. And finally, with the 11th step, I didn't even have a clue that that was more than just meditating and praying. I thought that's all it was. So I was trying to get some real fancy schmancy kind of Eastern kind of meditation going, you know, and that's all I wanted to do. And then I wanted to maybe get some different prayers. I have a prayer book that I use sometime, which is all fine. But I hadn't incorporated it exactly the way the book suggests, which makes me know that it's a daily, 24 hours a day situation. It is not just in the morning and at night. It's throughout the day. And again, I ask myself every night, where was I resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? That must mean because I probably have been today. I mean, it's not anything that goes away. Do I owe anyone an apology? I might. You know, who knows? Some days I do, some days I don't. Was I thinking of myself most of the time? Probably, you know. But was I thinking about anybody at all? Hopefully. And if not, I can talk to God before I go to sleep and set things right and ask for guidance. Go to sleep, get up, start all over. Ask for guidance in the morning. Direction in the morning, first thing. And then in 12, I get to just be me, sober, show up, be there in my skin, doing the best I can do according to the other steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and helpful to other people when needed. Anybody. Just showing up and sitting in a chair is a 12-step activity. Sober is a 12-step activity. And there's just so much more that I'm learning on a daily basis. I am not finished with anything. I know you hope I'm finished here, but I am not finished yet. God's not done with me yet. I don't think, I hope I don't say that when I used to do stuff sometimes, because there's a whole lot of stuff I still do. I don't drink alcohol anymore. I don't do drugs anymore. I don't do a lot of the behavior that's associated with getting that stuff and doing that stuff and being sick from that stuff anymore. I still get afraid. I still get angry. I still have reactions to certain kinds of behavior that I have learned about in my fourth step and that today I can do something about. And that's freedom to me. Because when I was a practicing drunk, I could never do anything about anything. I could never do anything about anything. I was always stuck. Today I can tell you that as long as I remember on a daily basis that I am truly an alcoholic, a real alcoholic, and I say real alcoholic because I was 3 years sober before I ever knew that I really was an alcoholic. And the way I found out was a real alcoholic stood up here and said, if you're wondering if you are or not, read page 21 and 22 in the big book. Decide. You're going to have to decide. When I was 3 years sober, I read it, and there I was, and I finally became real. For the first time in my life, I became authentic. And I became something that I could do something about. That has been the greatest freedom I have ever experienced. And that has allowed me to come to Georgia and have thrown up enough and pissed off enough people that you want to hear what it is I have to say, which is the most bizarre thing to me that Alcoholics Anonymous does. We do all the dirt, and then somebody says, we love you, keep coming back. It's a Zen thing. It just is. I'll never really understand it. I'll never figure it out. But thank God Bill wrote the directions in the book, and for some reason, as bizarre as it is, I can kind of understand some of the things we're supposed to do. And if I don't, there's some alcoholic out there that quickly is going to set me straight, you know, which I love. And I love the fact that we do this kind of thing to reaffirm who we are and why we're here. I want to thank you again for everything. Thank you for being my home, because I really am home for the first time in my life. And I got to pick it, I think. Maybe God picked it, who knows. But for the first time in my life, I am at home in myself. And I thank you for that.